Hello, I'm Smita Tharoor, and welcome to Stories of Unconscious Bias, a podcast where I ask guests from around the world to share their story and to reflect on their life experiences with unconscious bias. I hope you enjoy listening. They were recorded globally under COVID-19 lockdown conditions. On May 25th, Edward Mortimer, Fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, former Director of Communications at the United Nations, and Senior Vice President of the Salzburg Global Seminar, gave a talk to his colleagues at Oxford on contested histories in public spaces. He said, "To those who would like to brush all these issues aside with some such remark as you can't rewrite history, I reply, first, that is precisely what historians are doing all the time, since history is always written for the reader in the present and reflects the concerns of the present while interpreting and reinterpreting the past. Prescient, wise, and measured words in the light of the public conversation of removing statues from their plinths." In my interview with Cheryl Hernandez, she shows us the importance of not being stuck in our history, but learning from it and reflecting. It is about interpreting and reinterpreting the past and understanding ourselves better each time. Welcome to my podcast series on the unconscious bias. I am pleased to say that I have one very interesting person, Cheryl Hernandez, currently living in Trinidad, in fact, always living in Trinidad. Cheryl is an executive trainer, life coach, author, and international speaker from Trinidad and Tobago, who has spent over 40 years helping clients to improve their personal and professional relationships. Her experience runs from CEOs to teenagers and includes specialties like improved group dynamics, leadership skills, and emotional intelligence. Formerly a music teacher and ordained minister, Cheryl is known for her ability to turn difficult students and employees around. So as you can imagine, this is going to be an extremely interesting conversation with Cheryl Hernandez on unconscious bias. Thank you so much for joining us on this topic.
Thank you, Smita, for inviting me.
So, Cheryl, unconscious bias. What are your understanding by that? Those two words, unconscious bias?
Well, I look at it as our automatic conditioned reaction to people and situations. And this is based on our programming from caregivers, school, church, from society as a whole, about what is good and bad. And therefore, with that kind of programming, our reaction is unconscious. And we go about choosing and making preferences based on that programming.
So, for example, I mean, just to kind of give some more context, I completely agree with you. But what does that look like then when you're making a choice because of programming?
Okay, for example, I could use my 9-year-old granddaughter who goes to a denominational school. She has to study their religion as one of the subjects there. And we love to have discussions on what goes on in school, and she would tell me things that she would learn. And she'd say to me, Granny, do you know that these people, people who become from this particular religion, they have plenty gods? They don't have one god, you know. They are really not of God. And do you know that this other religion, X, Y, Z, and she says all these negative things about the other religions, and I knew it was coming from school. So I said to her, "And you believe all that?" "Yes, because the teacher said so and so." I said, "But I have a different view. I don't believe that." She said, "How do you mean you don't believe that?" I said, "Because that is their view of other religions, but I do not share that view, and many people do not share that view. When you grow up, by then you would have different views of different religions, and you will be able to choose which one you want. But right now, all you are getting from your school is their view. Remember that." And I told her, I said, Yeah, remember that you told me that Carnival, Trinidad Carnival, is all about devil worship. Am I a devil? I am always involved in Carnival. I said, no, Granny. I said, well, that's my point.
Very good point, and very, very aptly said to a 9-year-old. And she's very lucky to have you as a granny because she's learning at a very young age on beginning to not necessarily be programmed because somebody of influence is saying something. And that's the example you're giving, which is why it's so powerful. When people who you see as people of influence, it could be your parents, it could be your grandparents, it could be your teachers. It's people who you respect, who you feel are saying the right thing. And they say X, Y, or Z, and you believe it without even questioning it. But, you know, and that's what's really fascinating. And I'm glad that she has you to think differently. But what about you, Cheryl? So you are born and brought up in Trinidad. What kind of experiences have you had as a 9-year-old, which is many years ago? And what kind of stories can you share from those days?
One particular incident stands out because I learned a very powerful lesson that day. My brothers and I, we were looking out from our living room into the road, out of the, and we were looking out in between these large wooden, tall wooden louvers that we had. And I was about 10. They are 2 years. We are all 2 years apart. They were young. They are younger than me. I'm the eldest. And we are looking out through these louvers at the road, and we saw this group of people coming down the road. And my brother said to me, "Oh, the Indians are coming! The Indians are coming!" And the other brother said, "Let's sing the Indian song." And we said, "Okay." And when they got in front of us, we started to sing this Indian this song that children would use to tease Indians. So we started. Now, it might be a little derogatory, do should I not say it? I don't want to
No,
say
go ahead.
anything that.
It's a long time ago, and it's about us learning as well, Cheryl. So
Yes.
please do.
Okay. So we started. Coolie, coolie, come for roti, all the roti done. Mashed potato, all the potato done. And as we were about to sing our second round of it, we felt this burning, stinging feeling on our butts. And it was our mother with a belt. She jammed us against the louvers so we could not run. And we got a sound whooping and a long lecture on respecting people and not feeling that we are better than others. And she asked, "What did they do to you? Did they harass you?" "No, mommy." "So why would you harass the people?" And she gave us a lecture. She said, "I want you to know that nobody is better than the other person. It doesn't matter what race we are, where we are working." And she went on and on and on. But we got a song whipping and learned a powerful lesson that day. Because you
Well,
see,
that's
in Trinidad, we have as children, we had these little songs we sang against each other in jest, but it was also used as a weapon because we had a song, similar song for each ethnic group, you know.
And that's what's interesting, you see, because there are a couple of things here from the story that you've said to me. And one is, of course, the fact that other than your parents who can be helping you and programming you or your teachers, there are also friends. So you are 10 years old and you are in, you know, from school is where you learned the song or these
That's
songs,
right.
because it's not just one song, as you said, every ethnic group had a different song, including your own ethnic group, I imagine.
Yes,
So everybody had songs that they sang in jest to each other. And Trinidad was a composite of different ethnic groups. And
Yes.
so you felt it was in jest, but it was also a weapon. Now, that's what's really interesting because a couple of things I'm taking away from your story, Cheryl. One is the fact that even though Trinidad is a multicultural place, yet every ethnicity seemed to be together. That is also part of our own unconscious bias because we feel safe in our own groups. So the Indians are all together, the black people are all together, the Chinese people are all together, or whichever other groups you might have had. And perhaps those days, and how many years ago was this, Cheryl? would you say, give or take?
Oh, I was 10. You want me to give away my age?
Not at all. But I would say, if you're a grandmother, we're talking about at least 35 years ago, give or take, maybe more. So it's not in the last 15, 20 years. It was a different time in Trinidad as well. And so what I'm saying is that perhaps things have changed in Trinidad today because you continue to live there. I don't know, but it's something I'd love to explore in terms of people's ethnicities and our own unconscious biases towards other groups. You were 10 years old. You're no longer 10 years old. You are, you know, 30 years older than 10 years old, at least, probably more than that. And therefore, when your life experiences in Trinidad, have that shaped you in a different way? Clearly your parenting and your mother giving you a whooping, as you correctly said.
Yes.
But what else in terms of your managing your unconscious biases?
Well, one thing about Trinidad is because we have two predominant ethnic groups, the Indo-Trinidadians and the Afro-Trinidadians. And then we might have a little 1% Syrian, 1% Chinese. And we all go to school together. We all eat each other's food. In my days, we used to laugh at the Indians who would come with their brown paper bags for lunch with greasy stuff in it, roti and so on. Now we're in long queues to buy roti. And we share each other's food and cultures and so on. So it's different. And then there's the races mixing with each other. So we have a lot of mixed children. And one thing about our culture that makes it a little challenging for us when we come abroad and to places like the UK and the US, some of the biases and the discrimination go straight over our heads because we're not accustomed to it.
What does that mean? That's a very interesting point that you have made.
Sometimes I would encounter something when I am visiting the UK, which I do very often. And somebody would say something to me. And after I move away, my daughter would say, you know what they really said to you there? They didn't want to serve you. I said, really? That's what it meant? I'm totally oblivious. She said, Mommy, you'll get accustomed to it. I had to get accustomed to it because quite a few times things just went over my head and I really couldn't understand. And because of friends, they had to bring it home to me. You know, so
that's a very interesting point that you've made, Cheryl. And I want to just, I want to explore that a little bit more. Because what to me, what I'm understanding, and you could certainly go down a different path if you like, it's something about your own identity. Now, you are born and brought up in Trinidad. You are very confident in your own identity. And so when you visit another country, whether it's London or whether it's New York or wherever it might be, you are comfortable in who you are. And therefore, when people say whatever they might be saying, you know, it goes over your head.
Whereas, well, not anymore. I'm aware that I'm in a different place and it's a different culture. And so I'm more aware now. But in my early days of traveling, I missed a lot of the insults that were hurled at me. Because, I mean, you said that. I remember early in life, it was about 1967, when my aunt and I went to New York. And we went into a certain restaurant and we sat there and wondered why we were taking so long to be served. And then we realized that people who came after us were being served. And so we just called the waiter, excuse me, we are here. We've been here before these people. Little did we know that they didn't serve black people there. And we would hear demanding service. So it's something that we became aware of and were conscious of and conducted ourselves accordingly and looked out for it eventually.
Conducted ourselves accordingly.
Accordingly,
so what does that, but that's also a very interesting phrase that you've just said, Cheryl. So what does that mean then? What does that mean in terms of us managing our own reactions and to situations?
Well, in future, we were mindful of places that we entered, we were looking out now for certain behaviors towards us and so on. And we were just very aware.
That's and also at the point of being very aware is from my understanding is about keeping ourselves safe, you see, because yes. When we have had difficult experiences, whether they're traumatic or whether they're difficult or something that has hurt us, we don't want to experience that again. So what we tend to do is protect ourselves. And the way you've protected yourself is becoming hyper-aware and trying to make sure you do not go into that situation again. So thank you for sharing that. That's very honest of you, because it couldn't have been easy for you as a young person, you know, young girl sitting in New York, so excited. You've left home from Trinidad. You go to this big city. You know, you are looking at it with wonder, and this is the experience you have, which is sad, to say the least. Gerald, just to come back to your other experiences in Trinidad and because of what you do for a living, which is at so many different levels. You're at one level, you advise both young people and elders to change and to manage their emotions. Plus, you're an ordained minister. What's that about?
Well, I was an ordained minister. I conducted I was aligned to a group in the Universal Foundation for Better Living in Miami. And I formed a study group in alignment with that organization. And I conducted that study group for 12 years. I'm no longer involved in it. But we had been there studying spiritual books, the Bible, and it was really not a church, but it was more of a study group where we would just study things, you know. And my other example that I would like to share with you concerning me being biased towards somebody in that study group and didn't realize really that it was a kind of bias is that our group decided one year that Trinidad was celebrating its 50th anniversary of independence. And we decided that we would celebrate it in our own way. The participants or members of my study group were so excited about this idea that they formed themselves into little subgroups, and they organized who would be dealing with calling in guest speakers, performers, and so on. And they asked for volunteers. People came in and they started working excitedly. Then about 2 weeks into our planning, this particular member came to me and said, "Cheryl, I didn't volunteer before. I didn't think I was available. I'm available now. I want to be part of this. Which group can I join?" In my mind right away, I said to myself, "I don't want you to join any group because you have a reputation for stalling things. You're always late. You cause a lot of confusion. And right now they're working a pace and I don't want you to join any group." So right away, I am kind of discriminating against her. And she said to me, "But I am willing to join anything, you know." So I said to her, "Listen, let me talk to other groups and see if they need any more help." And when I went to the groups and I asked them, I said, let's call her Jenny. "Jenny wants to join." Everybody said, no, "We're going good. We're going fine. We don't want any stumbling blocks. No." I was glad they said no, because in my head I said no. But how was I to go back now and tell her? So I said to her, "Listen, I spoke to the group members. They said they didn't need any more help. But you know what? You could help me. I have to be here. I'm not in a group. I'm overseeing the groups, but my role is to fix and set up the room for each session. Could you come 1 hour before and join me and help me do that?" Now, I know she has a problem with punctuality, so I'm literally setting her up. She said, "Yes, I could do that." I said, "Are you sure? Because I notice you do not come to the sessions on time. Are you sure?" She said, "Yes, I'm available." Of course, when the first session started, I arrived there an hour before. There was no signs of her. 10 minutes after, no sign. 15 minutes, I started to organize and so on. And that went on for the first 3 sessions. And we never had to speak about it because she never turned up in time. Oh, she turned up the first day when she came late. She said to me, I see you did everything already. I said, yes. She said, but I don't like where those chairs are. Could we move those chairs? I said, don't touch a thing. If you want to be part of this, you have to come 1 hour earlier and together we'll collaborate and so on. And she did, never made it. She never made it. But another incident made me aware that, hey, Gerald, you have a discrimination against people who don't move as quickly as you want them to move, who you think do not operate at the standard that you want them to operate. You just dismiss them and choose people who are working fast. And that came out at a workshop when one of the participants, they were asked to draw how this team is going. And one of the guys drew a car going up the hill and people bending out of the car, and some fell out of the car, but the driver, meaning me, is still going up the hill, oblivious to who's falling. Now, I was so upset. But at another level, I was saying, but yes, if you're not with me, you're holding me back, so drop out, jump out of the car. But in my thoughtful, reflective moments, I said, you know, this is a kind of bias. How would these other people ever grow if you just, you know, park them aside?
That's a great story, Cheryl.
Yeah. Yes.
Of course it is. It is about our own unconscious bias, about how we work. And if people are not able to keep up to the way we work, it's a great leadership lesson. Well, then they're not good enough. It's essentially what you're saying. I work at this pace, and if you don't manage my pace, you're not good enough. And that brilliant drawing that I can visualize in my mind's eye of this car going up the hill and people falling out of it, and you're driving along, oblivious to all the people falling off, which is whoever drew that. I mean, of course, you should thank them for helping you reflect and learn from that. It's a great management lesson, isn't it, Cheryl, for anyone who's in a working environment. About how we communicate to others and about our own unconscious biases. If we work in a particular way, a culture, a style of working, we expect everyone to just follow through. And if someone is wonderful and creative and innovative but does not follow through in exactly the same way as us, we choose not to accept them. And that's the lesson that certainly I'm taking away from here. Well, it's a great story. Thank you for sharing that, Cheryl. So can you share another story of your experiences? Clearly you have many rich experiences.
I could remember a time when I felt discriminated against in my own country. It was in the workplace when I was now starting my career as a trainer. I was doing a part-time job with this training company. I was there for about 5 years working there. The very nice director, he was a white man, and he didn't discriminate in any way as far as I was concerned. Most of his employees were black, and I never saw any signs of anything that made any of us uncomfortable. We loved him, as a matter of fact. And one day he came and he said to me, Cheryl, I want to start a new course. It's for executive presentations. I am choosing only executives, top execs in Trinidad and Tobago who are in the public view, and I'm offering this workshop to them so that they can improve on their presentations. But I want you to teach this class. Are you willing and able? I said, yes. So he said, but there's one condition, and that condition is that you have to be a participant in the class first, and then we could go from there doing the training to be a trainer of this course. So I said, no problem, I'm willing to do that. So they came, we had our first day, and on the first day, I started to get a little nervous about introducing myself, because when I heard all of them got up and say, I'm the head accountant here, I'm the CEO of this, and I said, oh my God, what am I to go and say? Am I just going to say I'm a trainer? But eventually I pulled myself together and I said, I'm presenting myself as myself. No airs, no fluff. And I told them very honestly, I'm here as a participant because I am being singled out to be the trainer of this course and so on. So everything went well that first the morning of that first session until lunchtime. When the director called me and said, listen, I have these chits here. Take these people down to the establishment that I organized with, the food court, and there are two tables reserved for you all there, and serve the chits and so on. Make sure they have they're all taken care of. But something didn't sit very well with me. I was asking myself, why is he asking me to do this? He's a director. He's a host. Well, I'm a participant. And but I did it. We had a good time eating and drinking, and I made some good connections and so on. Now, the second day, it got worse. And at lunchtime, there was a big bin with food in it. The food was individually parceled and so on. But he called me aside. He said, Cheryl, this time we're eating upstairs here. Could you just share out the food, distribute the food? Just put up one in front of everyone. And I got so upset. He could have seen the changes in my mood and face just as I saw the changes in his mood and face when I did what I did. When he told me that, I said, but what happened to this man at all? Why did he single me out? Is it because I'm the only woman in the class? Is it because I am black and he's white? Is it because I'm an employee and he's my employer? Why did he single me out and he's a host? He should be sharing this. So I was so upset. Smita, my response was one of protest. I stood up right there after he told me that. And I said, hey, guys, the food is here. We're eating upstairs today. So everybody just dive in, take what you want. There are no choices of meat. Everything is chicken. Just dive in. And I saw this man, this white man became so red in front of me. And he narrowed his eyes and looked at me. And I knew he was upset. But I was more upset because I felt he was out of place to ask me to do that. In hindsight, Smita, I looked back at that situation and I said, you know, he must have thought that I was such an ungrateful character because this whole opportunity was free for me. The least that I could have done was help him host this first class. But he could have made it clear from before, listen, Cheryl, I want you to help me. You said as it was on one condition that I be a student in the class, but you didn't tell me about this food part. So if we had a conversation even before and even after, because we didn't speak to each other for weeks after, we never discussed it. Of course, I never taught the class. We never went on with the training. He was so mad. So I'm looking back at it now and I'm seeing where this man who never treated us in any discriminatory manner, I looked at him in this way because of my own stuff in my head. And I'm seeing now where discrimination and biases could be all in a person's mind. And, you know, an open conversation could have cleared all of this up. He may not have been thinking any of those thoughts that I was thinking, that, oh, she's a woman, so let her share. All that stuff was mine. So sometimes I'm confused about this unconscious bias stuff when we accuse people of being discriminatory towards us, when sometimes they aren't, but it's just our stuff. What do you say brilliant. About that?
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Well, I was smiling when you were saying the last bit of your story, because so many times it is about our own unconscious biases. And certainly my take on your story is the fact that you were perhaps, because you were, as you already said, feeling slightly insecure about being with all these CEOs, and you was thinking, I'm a trainer and how is that going to work?
Yes.
And so you were feeling a little insecure being amongst these big wigs. It's got nothing to do with color of skin or any of that.
Yes.
And
yes.
That then followed through. And when your colleague asked you to serve the food, you decided to hang your hat on that and to use that as a reason for you to feel offended. Maybe he was choosing you because you were a woman, but I think you're probably right. I suspect you were working together anyway. He was your manager.
Yes.
He had hired you and you were going to be running the course. Two things here. One is your own unconscious biases about how people could be perceiving you, which is brilliant, and I'm so glad for sharing that. And the second part that we're learning from your story is about communication. And you are so right. So many of us will say something based on what's in our head, but we don't say it clearly and concisely and properly and confirm that the listener who I'm speaking to has understood exactly what's in my head. If he had only said to you, listen, we are hosting this together.
Yes.
I'd like for you to attend, but in addition, could you do da-da-da-da-da-da-da? You wouldn't have had a problem with
it. I would not have had a problem.
But that was not even mentioned. And you were feeling insecure and having your own, you know, stuff going on. And so you'd make him something else. Great story, Cheryl. Great story. Thank you for sharing that. So, I mean, I could keep talking and talking, but we are running out of time. And I want to ask you, Cheryl, for you to, you know, your wisdom and your experiences, for example, how you've shared with your granddaughter, share with us, what kind of advice can you give us with all the different experiences you've got? How do we manage our unconscious biases? Because guess what? We all have them and we'll all continue to have them. So then what do we do?
I could think of three small steps we could take.
Fantastic.
Yeah. We have to first understand that we cannot fix another person in any way. We cannot change their biases. We can't make them think another way. The only person we have control over is us, our own selves. So the first step is, I would say, if we really want to work on this and work on self, is we need to be less focused on who is being biased against us. That's the first step. The second thing is that we need to work on improving our level of self-awareness so that we can be aware of where our biases lie. And because the only person we could fix is us. So just as I was able to reflect on those experiences I shared with you, we have to always be going back and examining self. So be self-aware about where our own biases lie. And thirdly, being aware of our own biases now may not help them go away, as you rightly said, but we have the power to manage what we are aware of for better interactions with others and for our own good. So the third step is really managing what we are aware of. We cannot manage what we're not aware of. So once we are aware of our biases, the third step, manage them, consciously manage them. That's my...
Great. Great top tips. Three top tips. Number one, recognize and acknowledge that we can't help anybody else. We can only help ourselves. We can only improve ourselves. How do we do that? We self-reflect. And then once we self-reflect and start beginning to become aware, then it's about managing. Fantastic. Thank you so very much, Cheryl. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you again.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too. Thanks for asking me, Smita.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you for listening to Stories of Unconscious Bias with me, Smita Tharoor. Stay tuned for the next interview in a week's time. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on my episodes @SmitaTharoor.